from my heart, from my mind, from my strength, I will worship you.
First Samuel chapter 13. We've seen the nation make this transition from the time of the judges, when God would use men like Samuel to guide the nation, to the time of the kings. Our first king that we now are looking at is King Saul, anointed to be the first king during a time when the Ammonites were threatening the nation. They were hassling everybody on the eastern side of the Jordan River, and they had besieged the town of Jabesh-Gilead. And you can surprise her. I'm sorry. I'm just all flustered having Luis in here. Okay. So Saul is anointed to be king during the time of this national crisis, when the Ammonites are trying to wipe out everything on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Saul is able to raise an army of 300,000. God uses him to bring a great victory to Israel. And now things are settling down a little bit. Chapter 13, verse 1. Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel. 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and in the mountains of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. The rest of the people he sent away, every man to his tent. Now, just a quick word about verse 1. Some of yours don't sound anything. Some versions don't sound anything like what I read. Donna's going, yes, yes. What's with this? Well, the Hebrew is a bit unclear. And so some versions say that he reigned when he was 30 years old, and he reigned until he reigned for 42 years. There's all kinds of combinations of these things. But the numbers 30 and 40 aren't in the text. It's just what the translators are trying to figure out, because some people think that there's got to be something missing, because it's just very vague in the Hebrew. I kind of like the way the New King James and the King James, and I think the English Standard Version, all have the same idea, that the previous chapter happened during his first year. What we're going to read about now in this chapter happens in his second year, because the 1 year and the 2 years, that's in the text. Verse 2, Saul chose for himself 3,000 men. So when Saul conquers the Ammonites back in 1 Samuel chapter 11, Saul had gathered an army of 330,000 men. From these men, he now whittles down his army to a mere 3,000. This is going to be like his standing army, kind of like National Guard, his National Police Force or something. This is going to be his guys who are always going to be on standby. He's going to command 2,000 men, and 1,000 men will be commanded by his oldest son, Jonathan. Jonathan, his name means Yahweh has given. Natan. Yahweh has given. He's in a sense, you could call him the crown prince of Israel. You know, you're going to see that develop throughout the rest of this book. He's the one who should be taking over when Saul is done reigning. It's kind of his to take. Verse 2, and it says that people are in Michmash. It mentions the mountains of Bethel and people in Gibeah. These cities, this is kind of looking in the mountains of Israel. There's Michmash to the right, Bethel to the left, and what am I looking at? Gibeah is back behind them. The Dead Sea's off to the right. Geba is a city that we're going to see in a minute that's occupied by the Philistines, kind of right in the middle of that. The Philistines have moved up. It's hard to see the green on the screen. That's too bad. The Philistines live in this area, but they've been pushing the borders in. And they're now kind of pushing in between the middle of the Israeli settlements. And they're it's starting to threaten things. Verse 3, and Jonathan attacked the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout all Israel, saying, let the Hebrews hear. And the idea of blowing a trumpet can carry a lot of different ideas. One of the main uses for blowing the trumpet is to gather people together, gathering an army together. Verse 4, now all Israel heard it said that Saul had attacked a garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel had also become an abomination to the Philistines. And the people were called together to Saul at Gilgal. Now, Gilgal, here's that area we were just looking at, Bethel, Michmash, and Gibeah. That's where their troops are. But down in the Jordan Valley is Gilgal. And that's that place that we saw last couple of weeks. After the destruction of Shiloh, Gilgal seems to be the place where they gathered the nation together for big events, for big group meetings. It's the place that Samuel told Saul, you shall go down before me to Gilgal, and surely I will come down to you to offer burnt offerings and make sacrifices of peace offerings. 7 days you shall wait till I come to you and show you what you should do. And we talked a few weeks ago that this is not just a one-time event. This is going to be their method of operation. And so you're going to see this play into the story. So the people are called together to Saul at Gilgal. Verse 5, then the Philistines gathered together to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. And they came up and encamped at Michmash to the east of Beth Horon. Now it says they've got 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, people as many as the sand on the seashore. Huge army. They've got a huge army. Perhaps they've heard about Saul's battle the previous year with the Ammonites, where Saul was able to gather 330,000 Israelites. At one point, Saul had a huge army. So they figure if we're going to come against Israel, we better have a huger army. Chariots, horsemen, that's the advanced weapon systems of those days. Israel has none of this. Israel doesn't have horses. They don't have chariots. So they are extremely mismatched. It's kind of like, you know, Afghani horsemen coming up against the American tanks and stealth bombers and Apache helicopters and everything. It's kind of that in those terms. But right now, Israel doesn't have an army of 300,000 men. Their army is only how big? 3,000. They're only 3,000 in the Israelite army. It says the Philistine army was as many as the people as the sand on the seashore. Josephus tells us that it was 300,000. So besides the 30,000 chariots, the 6,000 horsemen, possibly 300,000 foot soldiers, this is a huge army. It says they came up and encamped. Now, they encamp at Michmash, and remember their garrison had been at Geba, and that's where Jonathan initially attacks them, is at Geba, and then they bring up this huge force. Where's my huge force? Oh, come on. There it is. There's my huge Philistine force comes in from the west, and they're covering this whole area while Israel heads down to Gilgal to meet together to figure out what they're going to do. Verse 6. When the men of Israel saw that they were in danger, for the people were distressed, then the people hid in caves, in thickets, in rocks, in holes, and in pits. Now, instead of the whole nation gathering together like they did when the Ammonites attacked, and remember, of course, Saul used a little mafia strategy, what the mafia, you know, leaves a dead horse's head on your pillow or something like this, and it freaks you out. And remember Saul's thing? He cut an ox up into 12 pieces, and everybody got a piece of the ox, and they got freaked out, and they all showed up. You know, this time he doesn't do that, but this time instead of nation gathering, actually gathering to Gilgal, now they start to scatter. His army's going to go. It starts at 300,000. He whittles it down to 3,000. It's going to come down to 600 men, is as big as he's got. Now, see, the Lone Ranger and Tonto, they're riding along towards the north. They spot a war party of about 50 Apaches coming at them. They turn south, and another war party appears. So they turn east and meet another party of 100 braves. Then they turn west, and their last remaining hope, and they see a party of 500 Apache braves. The Lone Ranger turns to his friend and says,
"Well, faithful friend, this is the end. There's not much we can do."
Tonto looks back at the Lone Ranger and says, "What you mean, we, white man?" Oh, come on. It was a bad joke. You already know that joke. I've already told it 5 times. Yeah, sorry. But that's what's happening here. The people aren't sticking together. They're going off every which way. This is not a good thing. Verse 7. And some of the Hebrews crossed over the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. As for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. So Gad and Gilead. So the idea is that Philistine army closes in, and the people that are gathered at Gilgal, a bunch of them, head off across the Jordan River to where they think it's going to be safe. Verse 8, then he waited 7 days, because that's like the formula, right? That's what he's supposed to do. He's supposed to go to Gilgal, wait for 7 days, wait for Samuel to show up, offer the sacrifices, and figure out what they're going to do. So he waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. So Saul said, "Bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me." And he offered the burnt offering. And whether he's actually doing it himself, he's probably got a priest doing it. I'm not sure you want to go down the road of thinking that he's breaking the law by doing his own sacrifice. Probably got a priest doing it for him. Now it happened as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering that Samuel came. Don't you know it's always that way, isn't it? You know, you figure it's too late, so you go ahead and do something, and then they show up. That's what happened. As soon as he finished presenting the burnt offering, Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him, that he might greet him. And Samuel said, What have you done? Saul said, "When I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, 'The Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication to the Lord.' Therefore, I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering." This is something that we're going to see is kind of built into Saul. He's a man of excuses. He's always making excuses. If you look at what he's saying, his implication is, well, everybody else is to blame except me. I mean, the people are scattering. It's their fault. You didn't come. You know, it's your fault, Samuel. Well, what are you doing asking me what's happened? You didn't show up. And then, of course, then there's the Philistines are showing up. It's the Philistines' fault. It's everybody's fault but mine. And that tends to be Saul's M.O. It seems to be the way he lives a lot of his life, is by blaming everybody else except owning up to what is his responsibility. Are these things true that he says? Is it true that the people were leaving and that Samuel was late and that the Philistines were showing up? Yeah, they're all true. But he doesn't ever mention the fact that he has a choice that he could make. See, we like to blame everything else when there's still the issue of the fact that I still have a choice. I can still choose to do the right thing, or I can choose to do the wrong thing. It seems to me, gang, the older I get, that a mark of maturity comes when I stop blaming everybody else. I start owning up to what's my responsibility. When I'm apologizing, do I throw in a lot of buts? Well, yeah, I did it, but this was also happening. You know, and this was happening, and this was happening. And so, you know, yeah, I did it, but I'm beginning to think that the older I get, that the person that is mature in the Lord stops making excuses and simply owns up to what they did was wrong. Paul writes in Ephesians 4:15. This is a really cool verse. Paul says, "But speaking the truth in love, may grow up in all things unto him who is the head, Christ." Paul is talking about how the church matures and that the church can be carried about by every wind of doctrine, blown here, blown there. But the way the church grows up, stops being children, is by speaking the truth in love, owning up to the truth. That's how we grow up in all things as under Christ. No buts. No excuses. Verse 13. "And Samuel said to Saul, 'You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord has commanded you.' Then Samuel rose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people present with him, about 600 men." It says in verse 14 that God has sought for himself a man after his own heart. God's going to look for somebody who cares about what God cares about. And this is going to be who? It's David. It's one of the ways we refer to David, a man after God's own heart. And the idea is that whatever God cares about, David cares about. And it'll take a few years for this to happen. This is not going to happen overnight. But Samuel gives Saul the difficult news that, buddy, you're not fit to be king because you don't do what God asks you to do. How can you tell if someone is concerned about what is on God's heart? One simple word: obedience. Obedience. It's not the amount of tears that a person sheds. It's what they do. And that's the whole issue with Saul. The whole issue is that Saul doesn't do what God has asked him to do. Jesus said in John 14:15, Jesus said, "If you love me, keep my commandments." This is not like, you know, that girlfriend you had in high school who said, "Oh, you must not love me because you don't give me flowers," or whatever. This is not some pouty teen saying this. This is just the truth. If you love him, then you do what he asks you to do. That's just the truth. Jesus said, "How can you call me Lord if you don't do what I say?" And that's not to, I'm not saying this because we got to beat ourselves up over with this. This is simply the truth, isn't it? It's just simply the truth. If you love him, you'll do what he says. Saul is going to be known. His reputation over the years is going to be known by the times that he disobeys God. He disobeys God here in Gilgal. He will disobey God when it comes to dealing with the Amalekites in chapter 15. God's going to give him a command, and he's not going to quite do everything that God wants him to do. He's going to be known for disobeying God when it comes to the issue of he goes to a medium, to a witch at Endor, to try to get some advice because God won't speak to him, you know. And again, he breaks God's commandments. Obedience. God so longs for us to learn to obey because we love him. Chapter 13, verse 16. Saul, Jonathan his son, and the people present with him remained in Gibeah of Benjamin, but the Philistines encamped at Michmash. Then raiders came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned onto the road to Ophrah, to the land of Shual. Another company turned to the road to Beth Horon. And another company turned to the road to the border that overlooks the valley of Zeboim towards the wilderness. So, you know, the Philistines are encamped at Michmash, but they're now sending people out all in all directions to attack every Israelite that they can find. Verse 19. Now there was no blacksmith to be found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, let the Hebrews make swords or spears, lest the Hebrews make swords or spears. But all the Israelites would go down to the Philistines to sharpen each man's plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his sickle. And the charge for a sharpening was a pim for the plowshares, the mattocks, the forks, and the axes, and to set the points of the goads. So this is how the Philistines are trying to control this rabble-rousing group, these Israelites. It's like gun control. You know, we're not going to let them have any sharp objects. So we're not going to let them have any blacksmiths. They're not going to be allowed to have anything metal except if they want to plow their fields or something, but certainly no swords, no guns, no nothing like this. This is how they're trying to control these rebels. Verse 22. So it came about on the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan. But they were found with Saul and Jonathan, his son. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass at Michmash. So not only has Saul's army gone from 330,000 to 3,000, now to 600, but now they're just a bunch of farmers with sticks. Maybe rakes. I don't know. Maybe a couple of brooms they can, you know, hit somebody in the head with or something. But they're not exactly the most fierce fighting force in the world. The upper hand. Too often, gang, our eyes are on the wrong things when it comes to facing our battles. We think in terms of the size of the army, the kinds of weapons. The real issue is, who is on the side of God? Deuteronomy 20, God told his people before they came into the land, when you go out to battle against your enemies, and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you. That kind of fits, doesn't it? It's almost like it describes this chapter. He says, do not be afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. That's really all that counts. Is God on our side or not? Is God on our side or not? Romans 8:31, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? That needs to be our attitude, beloved. If God's on our side, who cares? Who cares if everybody else is bigger and badder and meaner and more smarter and have lawyers and all this kind of stuff? Who cares? God's on my side. What am I worried about? What am I worried about? Chapter 14. Now it happened one day. That Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who bore his armor, they call that an armor bearer. It's kind of like a golf caddy. You know, he's the guy that follows the boss around, and he's got a little golf cart, you know, and he's got the number 5 sword, you know, and the number 10 spear and all this kind of stuff, you know. He said to the young man who bore his armor, come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side. But he did not tell his father. This is what Jonathan does. He's got this idea. This idea has been kind of cooking in his head. But he's not going to tell dad about this. And Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men. Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, was wearing an ephod, but the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Now, mentions Ahijah, and that he's got an ephod, and that's just to let you know the ephod is some mysterious thing. It's God's some kind of a garment and has something to do with trying to figure out what God's trying to say. That's all that we need to worry about, because that's what you'll see this in a minute. People didn't know that Jonathan had gone. Verse 4, between the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other. And the name of one was Bozez, and the name of the other Sene. The front of one faced northward opposite Michmash, and the other southward opposite Gibeah. Now, this is the cool thing, Google Earth. Because you can see this thing. This is really cool. Okay, so here's Gibeah, where Saul is. Michmash is where the Philistines are. And off towards Michmash, there's this. It's in this canyon, is where Bozez and Sena are. They're two cliff faces that face each other. So the idea is that the Philistines are on one side, and the other side is Israeli territory. So to get from Sena to Bozez, you got to climb down into this canyon and then climb back up. That's the idea, okay? So you got the picture? So that sets the stage here. Verse 6, then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. For nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. So his armor bearer said to him, do all that is in your heart. Go then. Here I am with you according to your heart. This is just awesome. Jonathan is just like the bestest, isn't he? He's just the bestest. What a great example of faith for us, Jonathan. It's too bad that Saul got chosen king, because Jonathan would have done a good. I like Jonathan. I like Jonathan a lot. He says, it may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. He's got the heart of faith. He's an example of what faith is all about. All that matters to Jonathan is that he's fighting with God on his side. We always think the bigger is better. Jonathan knew better. I don't know if Jonathan is thinking about Gideon, but it wasn't, maybe a couple hundred years before their time. But the story of Gideon, you know, was all about God saying, you got too many people, you got too many people. You know, and they started out with 32,000 people, and then they whittled it down to 10,000. Now, if I had 32,000 people facing the Philistine army of 300,000 plus 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, even if I had 32,000, I would think that's not enough. Gideon had too many people. God got him down to 300. Why? Because God wanted to show everybody that it's not about you. It's about me. It's about God working. That's what really counts. The important issue in our lives is whether we're following God's lead, not whether we think we're doing a big enough thing or not. But the question is, where's God leading me? What's God wanting to do? Jonathan is an example of what we might say, someone who's going to step out in a venture of faith. Let's just see what God's going to do. Let's just give this a shot. Why not? Why not? He's got this silly notion. And I'm sure that if he told his dad would say, you're nuts. You're not going home. I'm going to confine you to the house, young man. How dare you? No, he's probably like in his 20s or 30s. I don't know how old he is right now. Absolutely amazing. And his armor bearer, I think, is almost just as amazing. Because personally, if my boss told me, and it's just me and him, and he says, let's go face the Philistine garrison. Think of, Han Solo and R2-D2 heading out against the Death Star. It's that kind of a picture. There's nothing new. This is George Lucas didn't have to search far to get these kind of ideas. He says, the armor bearer says, do all that's in your heart. I wonder about, at one point Saul at least had 3,000 men that he picked. Now he's down to 600. Where did the other 2,400 go? They ran. Too scary. They ran. This guy's not running. In fact, it's down to two. Him and his boss, and he's ready to go. You're going to support or you're going to run? You're going to support what God wants to do, even if it looks scary, or you're going to run? What a great story. We can't all be Jonathans. Sometimes we need to be the armor bearer. Sometimes there's a person that God calls you to be alongside of. And you can be the armor bearer. Not everybody's a Jonathan. When Moses sent Joshua out to fight the Amalekites, and Joshua's leading the army down in the valley, and Moses is up on the hill watching the whole thing, and just really kind of a funny thing. I think it's hilarious, personally, the story where, they're fighting away, and Moses starts, Oh God, help them, help them. And suddenly looks down and they start winning. He's going, this is awesome, God, you're awesome. Please, God, help them, help them. And they're fighting and fighting and they're winning and they're pushing back the Amalekites. And then Moses goes, wow, that's just like, they're starting to lose. Okay, God, help them, And he realizes that every time he's got his hands up in prayer, I'm assuming, some people say in surrender, some people say praising God, but it's reaching out to God. And as long as he's got his hands up, they're winning. They're winning. But after a while, it gets kind of hard. I mean, I don't know how long that thing happened. I mean, some of us can't even stick our hands up for a whole darn praise song. I mean, sometimes, when Dave's leading and I'm in the back, I'm going, oh. Well, Moses had two buddies, Aaron and Hur. And it says they sat him on a rock, and they each held up an arm. What a story of how God's work happens with the body of Christ. Some people are in the army down in the field fighting the battle. Some people are up on the hill praying. Some people are just supporting them, encouraging them, saying, go, 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 boy, go. Beautiful stuff. I love this armor bearer. Do all that's in your heart. Then Jonathan said, very well, let us cross over to these men and we will show ourselves to them. I'm just thinking, Jonathan, are you crazy? If they say thus to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place and not go up to them. But if they say to us, come up to us, then we will go up. For the Lord has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us. So they're kind of laying out a fleece. They're kind of trying to figure out. I know this is a wild idea. So let's put some checks in here. So I think the idea is that they're going down into that canyon. And if the Philistines see them and they say, you guys just stay down there, we're going to come down there and talk to you, then they're going to say, well, then we'll just do that. But if they invite us up, then that's going to be our sign that God's in this. And is this God? I think there's some wisdom to this, beloved, of making sure that God is leading you. Some of us, wasn't there a movie called The Year of Living Dangerously? Or some of us live our whole lives living dangerously. Well, there's a place for having some checks and balances. And is this really you, God? and testing the waters. You don't need to be a person who lives dangerously just because you get the high for living dangerously. But is this really you, God? Be sure that God's speaking. Put some tests out there. Is this you, God? Verse 11. So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. Now, I don't know how they did that. I probably got down in the valley and they went, help, whoa, hey, Philly up there, you know, you Philistines, not Philadelphia, Philadelphia, you Philistines, you know, whoa. They showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines, and the Philistines said,
look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden.
Remember, some of the people had been doing that. They just headed for the hills and hiding out in the caves. Then the men of the garrison called to Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us. We will show you something. Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has delivered them into the hand of Israel. I'm sure that the Philistines are just thinking these old country yokels. They don't have, what a bunch of jokers. You know, they're thinking they're going to challenge us. And Jonathan realizes this is God at work. And he gets moving. That's kind of something else we need to think about too, gang. Is that when you get the go, when you get the green light, do it. Do it. You don't just do all the testing and all the praying and all the waiting, and then God says go, and you say, wait, one more test. Just one more test. At some point, you got to step out. And Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees with his armor bearer after him. Because you saw that cliff. It's pretty steep. And they fell before Jonathan. And as he came after him, his armor bearer killed them. So, you know, they scaled these cliffs. And then Jonathan starts swinging. And he's knocking guys over. And his armor bearer is finishing them off. They're a team. You know, I think of the ninja movies, you know, and all this kind of stuff. You know, okay, so I watch too many ninja movies. Verse 14, that first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about half an acre of land. Half an acre, that's about half of the length of a football field, about 150 feet. So they go 50 yards, and by the time they've gone 50 yards, they've killed 20 Philistines. Now the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked. I don't think that they're watching from Gibeah. I think these guys are probably out by the cliff, probably. And they're watching the multitude melting away. And they went here and there. Watching the Philistines, something's happened across the valley. Oh my gosh, something's happening. Then Saul said to the people who were with him, now call the roll and see who has gone from us. And when they had called the roll, surprisingly, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. Saul doesn't know who's out there. He wants to know who's gone, what's going on. And he said, Saul said to Ahijah, this is the priest, remember, the guy who's got the ephod. He said to Ahijah, bring the ark of God here. For at that time, the ark was with the children of Israel. Now, we've talked about trying to track the location of the ark through these times. We saw that it went from Shiloh, it was captured by the Philistines. They took it and got into some medical problems and hemorrhoids and things like that, or whatever, some tumors or something. Then it gets sent back, they UPS it back to Beth Shemesh, or they ox cart it back to Beth Shemesh. They get in some trouble because those Israelites peek into the ark and get into trouble, and it ends up at Kiriath Jearim, and it's going to, that's more or less its permanent home, is at Kiriath Jearim. But apparently during the battle, they must have brought it up for a while up to Gibeah, where Saul is. Verse 19. Now it happened while Saul talked to the priest that the noise which was in the camp of the Philistines continued to increase. So Saul said to the priest, withdraw your hand. Now, again, we don't really know how this all works. The ephod, the Urim and Thummim, some people think can be involved in this kind of thing. we don't know how it was done. But somehow God would communicate answers to the priest. You know, there's the idea that the Urim and the Thummim were kept in the breastplate or a pouch on the chest of the high priest. And some people think it was a white stone and a black stone. And so you would have to ask God yes or no questions. And you close your eyes, you know, and spin around three times and, you know, reach in. And so people come up with all these ideas. The problem is that as you follow the scriptures, especially through Samuel, you will see them inquiring of the Lord. Sometimes it's a yes or no answer. Sometimes it's no answer. Sometimes it's wait till you hear the wind in the treetops. How do you get that out of a black and a white stone? I don't think it quite exactly works that way. I don't know if we know exactly how it happens, but this idea of withdrawing the hand is apparently the priest was beginning to ask God some questions. And the idea of withdrawing the hand is he says, well, it's like, hang up the phone. We got to do something. You know, you haven't made the connection yet with God. Let's just hang up. Let's go do something. That's the concept here. Because, gang, sometimes there's a time to move. Sometimes there's a time to move. Saul is going to make some mistakes this day. But I'm not sure this is one of them. Because he's not rebuked for this particular move that he makes. There are times, gang, when God is working and we need to jump in. We need to jump in and be a part of the action of what God is doing. When Moses and the people were pinned against the Red Sea and Pharaoh's chariots are coming down the canyon after them, and Pihahi wrote, and so there they are pinned against the Red Sea. There's no way out of this thing, and the only escape route is up the canyon where the Egyptians are on their way towards them, and this great verse in Exodus 14:15. Then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Tell the people to get moving already. I mean, like, you know, he's got the Red Sea parted, you know, and it's like God says, okay, I appreciate the prayers. That's really cool. Just please get going. I can't, you know, I'm not going to hold these people off forever. Get them moving. What? And see, gang, with all these things you see in the scripture, sometimes we like to make formulas about how to find out God's will. And there are some things that are consistent all along the way, yes. But not everything's consistent. There's a time to wait. My gosh, Saul's already gotten into trouble because he didn't wait, right? You know, he didn't wait for Samuel those 7 days. We're not told how much longer it was or whether it was that, you know, the clock struck midnight and Samuel showed up at 11:59. Or we don't know exactly what it was. Sometimes you need to wait, but sometimes you got to get up and move. Sometimes you just got to get up and move. Some of us are a bit too careful, and we need to get up and move. Verse 20. Then Saul and all the people who were with him assembled, and they went to the battle. And indeed, every man's sword was against his neighbor, and there was very great confusion. The idea with every man's sword against his neighbor, the idea is the Philistines are already fighting each other. They're in such confusion that they're killing each other as well. Verse 21, moreover, the Hebrews who were with the Philistines before that time, who went up with them into the camp from the surrounding country, they also joined the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Now, some of these might have been the people who fled to the caves. That could be some of them. But some of them could be Israelites who have joined the empire. They've left the rebel cause because they can see the writing on the wall. They can tell that the Philistine empire, you know, is the winning side, and so they've learned to, you know, carry the water and empty the buckets and do the menial things for the Philistines. So within the Philistine camp, I think that's what it's talking about, is that there's Israelites that are there, and they realize that their compadres are winning, and so they turn around and start fighting. Verse 22, likewise, all the men of Israel who had hidden hidden in the mountains of Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, they also followed hard after them in battle. So again, here's where it is. The people that were in the caves joined the battle. Josephus records that by at this point, Saul's army grows from 600 men to 10,000. So everybody likes to be on the winning side, don't they? So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle shifted to Beth Aven. So they've been in, the battle has been in Michmash. So this is where it all starts with Jonathan, and then the rest of Israel joins in here, and at Michmash, and they're starting now, they're now pushing them back to Beth Aven. It's about 2 miles away. Verse 24. And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had placed the people under oath, saying, "Cursed is the man who eats any food until evening, before I have taken vengeance on my enemies." So none of the people tasted food. Now, it sounds like a nice thing. You know, it's like, don't anybody stop for burgers, for Pete's sake. Let's finish this thing. Let's do this thing right.
I don't want anybody eating until the end of the day or until I vanquish my enemies.
Now, that's kind of a, you know, that's a noble thought. But it's also a stupid idea. Some of us guys come up with pretty stupid ideas. You know, I don't know what you think of these ideas. You know, I think they're kind of stupid. You know, guy vacuuming on a lawnmower in his living room and the kid trying to go down the ramp. I probably would have tried that as a child. And then the kid trying to explore the electrical outlet with a knife. Now, you know, us guys, we come up with some stupid ideas. Saul makes the people stop and promise not to stop and eat anything until evening. Now, gang, fasting is a good thing when you're seeking the Lord. That can be a good thing. But not when you're fighting a battle. I mean, don't you need carbs? I mean, you gotta pack the carbs in if you're going to be swinging swords and lopping off heads and, you know, gutting Philistines and all those kind of bodies, bopping them on the head or something, right? You need carbs, right? Saul has done some brilliant things as a king. This is not one of them. So he makes them swear this oath. No food till evening. Verse 25. Now all the people of the land came to a forest, and there was honey on the ground. Now the idea is there's, you know, honeybees, hives up in the trees, dripping honey. And as they're walking through the forest, they see the swarm of bees. They look down, and there's some honey on the ground. Is the sound up, young man in the back? Okay, are we ready for the sound? Okay. And when the people had come into the woods, there was the honey dripping, but no one put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath, because, see, that counts as food, right? But Jonathan had not heard his father charge the people with the oath. Why? Why? Because he was the first guy out there. He was way ahead of everybody. Therefore, he stretched out the end of the rod that was in his hand and dipped it in a honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his countenance brightened. He just got, whoa, that tastes good. His countenance brightens. Now, I have a commercial that perfectly displays this. See, that's perfect illustration of this, right? So this is exactly the idea. Jonathan's starting to fight like Betty White. And he sees some honey and he goes, oh, it's probably Snickers honey. You know, and he sticks his staff in there and gets some on his, and eats it. And, you know, the little sugar rush, and he's ready. He's good to go. What a great idea. Do you want the Israeli army fighting like Betty White? Or Abe Vigoda? Well, no, of course not. So you can see how stupid this is, Saul's idea. Then one of the people said, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, 'Cursed is the man who eats food this day.' And the people were faint." And Jonathan said, "My father has troubled the land." My father is stupid. That's the Hebrew version. look now how my countenance has brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. You know, Jonathan realizes his dad's done a stupid thing. How much better if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found. For now, would there not have been a much greater slaughter from the among the Philistines? Now, see, the Philistines support an army of 300 plus thousand. They've got to have, food trucks. You know, they probably have some roach coaches standing out there, you know, cooking up food, you know, and they have their taco carts, you know, and they've got probably herds of cattle and you know, they've got, you know, grocery store trucks lined up, you know, to feed these guys. But the Israelites can't touch it. Even though they've already overrun the camp, they can't touch this stuff. Verse 31, now they had driven back the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon, and the people were very faint. Ajalon is 15 miles from Michmash. Ajalon, you know, I wish I could show you the whole Israel. I'm sorry, maybe I should do that next time. But the Israelites at this point are living up in the hills. The Philistines own the coastal plain, which is to the left. Ajalon is like the last bit of the hill country. And so they have knocked the Philistine completely out of the hill country. They're gaining back their territory. Josephus records that they had killed many tens of thousands of Philistines. This is a huge, huge victory. Verse 32, and the people... And the people rushed on the spoil and took sheep, oxen, and calves and slaughtered them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. Now, this is the end of the day. So it's evening now. And so the people, you know, watch the sun go down below the horizon, and they realize, all right, we can finally eat. God has strictly prohibited his people not to eat meat with blood in it. This goes back to Leviticus 17:11. You don't eat meat with the blood in it because, and God sets up this whole system that the blood is supposed to remind you of the life of the animal. And God wants blood to have a specific meaning to people. The blood is the life, and that's what you're going to sprinkle on the altar so that when we talk about that animal paying with its life for you, that's how we do it. We represent it by taking the blood, putting the blood on the altar. So God instructed his people, don't touch blood. I don't want you to eat anything with blood in it. So they have very strict rituals as far as with the slaughter of animals to drain the blood. People get all carried up in the legalism of it, but the purpose is to set it up for the day when the Lamb of God, Jesus, would shed his blood for us. Communion. We talk about the cup of the covenant, of the new covenant, his blood shed for the remission of our sins. It's to remind us that he gave his blood, he gave his life in its substitution for us. He paid for us with his life. Now, the people know better, but my gosh, they are so darn hungry. They've been killing Philistines all day. And they haven't been allowed to have any wheat thins even. They just couldn't have nothing. And so they're just starving. And they see some of this, you know, some of these food trucks, you know, and actually they didn't have food trucks. They just had the herds laying there. And they just wanted to eat this stuff. And so verse 33, then they told Saul, saying, look, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood. I wonder who's always being the tattletales here, you know. People that told Jonathan, you know, your dad said no, eat anything. Now, these are probably the same people that are going, oh, look at these people on the internet, whatever, I don't know. They say, look, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood, which is true. So he said, you have dealt treacherously, roll a large stone to me this day. It is kind of fascinating, isn't it, that the people are more concerned about Saul's command not to eat anything until evening? They're more concerned about that than they are about God's command to not eat anything with the blood. That's kind of fascinating. And so he wants to roll a large stone because he's going to start slaughtering things properly. That's the idea. Then Saul said, "Disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, bring me here every man's ox and every man's sheep. Slaughter them here and eat. Do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood." So every one of the people brought his ox with him that night and slaughtered it there. Then Saul built an altar to the Lord. This was the first altar that he built to the Lord. Now, we might look at this and we're not sure whether is this a good thing that he built an altar or not. He doesn't receive an open rebuke for it, so I don't know. He does stop them eating things with the blood, and that maybe that makes it good. Verse 36, then Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light, and let us not leave a man of them." So he said, okay, everybody's fine. Is everybody done with their burgers? Everybody cleaned up, you know, is everybody now finally ready to go? Maybe we should like keep going. You know, maybe we should like fight all night. Aren't you pumped? Let's do this, you know. And they said, "Do ever seem what seems good to you?" Then the priest said, whoa. "Why don't we like ask God first? Let us draw near to God here." So Saul asked counsel of God. Now again, this is where probably this ephod is coming into place. Probably the high priest, Ahijah is probably involved here. And so they're now asking God, "What are we supposed to do? What are we supposed to do? Will you deliver them into the hand of Israel?" But he did not answer him that day. Is no dial tone. Picked up the phone. No dial tone. Checked his cell phone. No signal. No response. Line is dead. Nothing. Nada. Now, it could be because of sin. Isaiah 59 says the Lord's hand is not too short that he can't save. His ear is not too thick that he can't hear. But it's your sins that have come between you and God. And it's because of your sin that he can't hear you. It could be that. That's always a possibility when we feel like our prayers aren't getting anywhere. Yes, it could be our sin. Psalm 66:18, David says, "If I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear." So it could be some kind of a sin. That's what he's going to assume. It could be just because Saul's an idiot. And it could be that God just is like, you know, I'm just not going to answer you. It could be something like that. Verse 38. And Saul said, "Come over here, all you chiefs of the people, and know and see what this sin was today. For as the Lord lives, who saves Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die." But not a man among all the people answered him. Now, I'm sure when he's saying that, he's probably just kind of just saying that. He probably doesn't really think it could be his son Jonathan. I mean, he's the hero of the day. Then he said to all Israel, "You be on one side, and my son Jonathan and I will be on the other side." And they're kind of like draw straws kind of a thing and try to figure out, so who's the bad guys here? Who's the ones that are at fault? And I'm sure Saul is probably thinking it's you people, you know. And the people said to Saul, "Do what seems good to you." Therefore Saul said to the Lord God of Israel, "Give a perfect lot." And Saul and Jonathan were taken. What? And the people escaped. Wait. Could we do that again? Could we like roll the dice again? Could we choose pick straws again? How was it? Wait. That wasn't supposed to happen that way. Yeah, best two. Yeah, I like that, Dave. I like that. Best two out of three. And Saul said, "Well, cast lots between my son Jonathan and me." And Jonathan was taken. And Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you have done." And Jonathan told him and said, "I only tasted a little honey with the end of the rod that was in my hand. So now I must die." I don't know if it's being, you know, I'm almost read that a little bit cynically. So now I must die. But it very well could be, okay, Pop, I'm fine with that. You made the oath. I made it. My bad. It's okay. I'm going to die. And Saul answered, "God, do so and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan." It's just, how's that for a dad? Who'd you like to have him for a dad? You know? But the people said to Saul, "Shall Jonathan die, who has accomplished this great deliverance in Israel? Certainly not. As the Lord lives, Not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. He has worked with God this day. Duh. I mean, can you see that? Can you see that Jonathan was the hero of the whole story, right? He was, wasn't he? And so they rescued Jonathan. They rescued Jonathan. The word rescued, pada, the Hebrew word can mean to ransom or redeem or deliver. There's a law in Leviticus 27 about when you make foolish vows, how you can redeem if you swear by the life of your oldest son. You can buy your son out of that vow. That's an interesting law, Leviticus 27. I wonder if this is what they're talking about. Might not be. Might just be simply that they rescued him out of Saul's hand. I think that's an okay thing to do, gang, is to rescue people from foolishness. Because this is a foolish thing, isn't this? Trying to put Jonathan to death because he had a little bit of honey? Because you made a stupid vow? Yeah, I think it's okay to help rescue people from foolishness. I think we have people all around us who get caught in foolishness, right? It's a good thing to be a part of rescuing them from foolishness. Things that they do to hurt themselves. Then Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. Verse 47, and Saul established his sovereignty over Israel and fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the people of Ammon, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he harassed them. And the idea is that from this victory, things go forward. And they start taking more and more territory. Their enemies are subdued one after another. And it all started with the victory that started with one man who said, I wonder what God can do. I wonder what God can do. That's where it started, with Jonathan. And he gathered an army and attacked the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. The sons of Saul were Jonathan, Yishui, and Malchishua. The names of his two daughters were these: the name of the firstborn, Merab, and the name of the younger, Michal. We will meet them later. The name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the commander of his army was Abner, little Abner, and the son of Ner, his Saul's uncle. Kish was Saul's father, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. Now there was a fierce war with the Philistines all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he took him for himself. And actually, some of the language here talks about a strong man. It's a word that you could translate it, the tall men. He picked all the tall men, which could be that he picked the guys that looked like him. Because remember, he was a tall guy. And that's it. So let's stand. We did it. We finished two chapters. Pray that we might be men and women who every once in a while might be willing to be a Jonathan. Or maybe at least an armor bearer. Help us to discern your will, to hear your voice. Help us to step out when you're leading. Help us to rescue the perishing. We want to learn what it means to be lights in this world. We're so grateful, Lord, that you are not against us, you are for us. And even if each of us feels that we are small and insignificant, doesn't make any difference if you're on our side.